Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have an odd first martini, followed by bad and crazy. First, Jim, we should point out that by the time folks hear this, we'll probably know a lot more details of whatever is happening in London. There could be multiple incidents. We don't know. There seem to be reports about a car plowing into folks outside of Parliament, gunshots fired. We'll know a lot more about injuries and any fatalities as time goes on. In these early stages of any sort of reporting or investigation, we're likely to hear some things that may or may not turn out to actually be true. So rather than us speculate here as it's unfolding, we'll just keep an eye on it and talk about it more if necessary tomorrow, because jumping into the fray could just be a fool's errand at this point.
Yeah, our listeners, Greg, they don't need us to speculate and come up with crazy theories or completely unfounded explanations of what happened. That's what Twitter's for. So seriously, look, this looks bad. Thoughts and prayers with everybody over there, hoping they come through this okay. Undoubtedly, we'll probably know more by tomorrow and we'll have more to talk about. But until then, everybody just, you know, shelter in place, as they say, and hopefully everybody comes through this all right.
Well, yes, and stay tuned. I'm sure we'll learn much more about this as the day goes on. Jim, on to our first martini. Not a good martini, just kind of an important martini as we look towards tomorrow, and that's the date that's not only the seventh anniversary of Obamacare getting signed into law, it is also the day that House Republicans have decided to hold a vote on the American Health Care Act. Right now, there's a fierce scramble for votes. President Trump fiercely lobbying members of the House Freedom Caucus to try and get over the hump on this bill. Democrats want nothing to do with it, so it's going to have to be all Republicans or nobody. Right now, the supporters of this bill say Obamacare is cratering, and this bill is phase one of three phases that's necessary to undo the mandates, get rid of a lot of the taxes, and begin the process of helping the healthcare system out of this death spiral. Critics on the left say it's going to leave a lot of people unable to afford health insurance, and critics on the right say it's a failure to come through on the promise of full repeal of Obamacare, and actually they're very reluctant to believe that it's going to reduce costs at this point unless that third phase comes through, and they're not sure that it ever will. So, Jim, a fierce debate going on, particularly on the right. What do you expect to shake out here in the next day?
Well, I'm struck by seeing the likes of Paul Ryan and other House Republicans who really prefer this legislation or feel like this legislation is as good as it's going to get for the foreseeable future, who are making the argument of, look, guys, either we pass this or we're done with this for the year, that this is the only opportunity House Republicans have to repeal and replace Obamacare, and that if they vote no on this bill because it's not enough to their liking, they are effectively voting to keep Obamacare in place. Really, if this doesn't pass, we're giving up. It's done. We're not even going to try for the rest of the year. I realize they have a big, busy schedule, and they have lots of other legislation they want to pass, tax reform, talk of the infrastructure bill. The Senate's got to confirm Gorsuch. But guys, you kind of have been running on this for 6-7 years now. You can't say, nah, we tried. We didn't have the votes. Never mind. You know. So my suspicion is it sounds like they're making a threat that if I'm a House Republican, I'm not sure I even believe that threat. It sounds like a bluff to me. And the second thing is, if they went through with that bluff, you want to talk about cutting off your nose to spite your face. You know, what would the harm be in saying, well, we didn't have the votes for this. We're going to start over again, back to the drawing board. I think what almost every Republican on Capitol Hill should recognize is that almost any version of this that has a chance of passing is not going to look that different. Or you can move it in the direction of, say, Rand Paul would like to see, because the argument is that the current legislation doesn't do enough, that it keeps too much of the basic infrastructure of Obamacare in place, and it basically gives a Republican stamp of approval to the idea the job of the government is to help you pay for your health insurance. So if you move in that direction of Rand Paul or the House Republican Study Committee, then, of course, you move over to – you lose the Tom Cottons of the world and in some of the Republican governors who are like, well, wait a second. We have a whole lot of people who are on Medicaid. We need to make this transition as gradual and easy for these people as possible. We don't want to just, you know, tell these people, a good portion of which voted for President Trump, we are yanking away your access to health insurance and now you got to pay for it yourself. Because as many folks have noticed, under the Affordable Care Act, health insurance isn't more affordable. So it's something of a catch-22 or caught between a rock and a hard place. I think I'd like to see Republicans kind of recognize that almost any reform – like they've made two big mistakes here. One is that they basically told their base that repeal and replace was going to be easy, and they really left the impression that everybody's going to like the replacement. Well, they're not. You can either make it as politically palatable as possible and do as little as possible to remove people from the existing benefits they get under Obamacare. It's not going to, or you can move in the direction which is going to be better for the deficit and remove it away from an entitlement spending and the expansion that it represented under Obamacare. It's very hard to do both. And to get stuff through like tort reform or the selling of insurance across state lines, the competition that was meant to bring the rates down and make it more affordable for people, well, you can't do that through reconciliation, which means you got to do it through separate legislation, which means it's going to need 60 votes to get through the Senate, or you can nuke the filibuster. For obvious reasons, Senate Republicans are a little wary about that, because if you do that, well, then the moment Democrats get to control of the Senate, they can get through anything they want either. So it's a tough situation for Republicans. My sense is if you're a Republican, you kind of have to pass this just so you can go to the Senate. Let the Senate come up with its version and its changes. And then once it does that, you go to conference, and maybe in conference you can improve the bill more to your liking. But Greg, I found it very revealing yesterday that the sales pitch from Trump yesterday was not, this is really good legislation and it's going to do a lot of what we wanted to do when we envisioned a good replacement for Obamacare. The sales pitch was much more, we need this and we will lose our majority if we don't pass this. And if you don't support me, I'll remember you. None of this are like, hey, it's a good bill, which is a little unnerving and I think probably revealing. Having said that, if you're a Republican, it's better if the replacement process continues than for it to get cut off now and the next step very much an open question.
Yes, and it faces, even if it can get through the House, which is uncertain at this point, an uncertain future in the Senate. As you mentioned, Cotton is a no, Mike Lee's a no, Rand Paul's definitely a no, Susan Collins, for very different reasons, is a no, and a lot of folks think Ted Cruz might end up there as well, unless there are major changes to the bill. Jim, for a president who in the debates basically boiled down his reform to getting rid of the lines, were you surprised at all that he wasn't focused more on nuance and more on just the general get on board pitch?
No. And by the way, like, for those of us who said, oh, Trump is shallow, Trump has never bothers to read the white papers, he just kind of he gets his information from Breitbart and from Twitter, and he's not a policy wonk. This is where it catches up with you. Right. The reason Republicans aren't happy with it is they're not happy with the details of the bill, but the details of the bill matter. And by the way, it's not simply that, it's the squishes like Susan Collins who don't like things like the idea of yanking away Medicare. Cory Gardner, right? I think just almost anybody's, certainly conservative enough in most people's books. He's wary about this. Scott Walker definitely wants as much flexibility in the Medicaid as possible. You know, look, there's an advantage to knowing this stuff, and there's a sneaking suspicion, I suspect, amongst a lot of Republicans that, look, Trump wants a bill passed. Trump wants to sign it. He wants the perception of victory. What's actually in the bill doesn't matter nearly as much to him.
Hmm. That's what conservatives are all about, just getting the votes.
Yeah.
Let's move on to our official bad martini here. And this goes to a story that I believe broke late last week, and that was the allegations of the rape of a 14-year-old girl at Rockville High School, and that's in Montgomery County, Maryland, just north of Washington, D.C. One of the things that's been bizarre about this story that is now getting state and national attention, it actually came up at the presidential press secretary briefing at the White House on Tuesday, is the way that the local officials are reacting. Jim, you lead off the Morning Jolt with this story today, and here's a little bit of what Jim wrote. County citizens have since learned that an illegal immigrant can be 18 years old, enroll in the public schools, undergo no background check, and because they have no verifiable high school credits, automatically be enrolled as a freshman, putting them in the same classes as 14 and 15-year-olds. Under the law, the school cannot ask about the student's immigration status. The school system chooses not to perform background checks on incoming students. And instead of focusing entirely on these horrible people who committed this act, the liberal officials in Montgomery County are more worried about the way people might think about people who are in the area illegally. This is a district superintendent, Jack Smith. Quote, this horrible incident should not change anyone's mind that those schools are safe for our students, and we work very hard, and our families and our community works very hard to keep all children safe in Montgomery County. So it's kind of like every time there's a terrorist attack, Jim, we got to worry about the backlash that never really seems to happen, as opposed to the horrific act that actually did. But I guess we shouldn't be surprised given who's in charge there.
Yeah. This way, there's an interesting buzz that this could end up being a, what the Washington Post would once call a local crime story. It could end up being very, very vivid national news because there's a landmark 1982 decision from the Supreme Court called Plyler versus Doe, which basically says all children are entitled to a public education regardless of citizenship or immigration status. And what's more, the schools cannot ask about them. They cannot require you to show a social security number or anything like that. The estimates vary, but they're roughly in the neighborhood of 770,000 undocumented immigrants or illegal immigrants, as most of us call them. Kids are in U.S. schools, public school systems. Now, if you're a green card holder, we've discussed in the debates about President Trump's executive orders, you go through a background check, right? Most people, most schools have a pretty good sense of whether the students coming to their school are criminals. That basically the whole bunch of juvenile courts, if they are, if a student is involved with certain crimes, basically drugs, violence, anything involving a weapon or gangs, the court is kind of required to notify the school. Now, obviously, for obvious reasons, we try to keep juvenile records under seal. We don't want a mistake somebody makes as a teenager following them around for the rest of their lives. But the courts have also understood that there is a potential public safety risk if you have a student, most likely a teenager. We're not talking about, kindergartners or first graders or anybody like that. But if you have a teenager who's got, violent crimes in his past, the school has a right to know so that they can take whatever steps they deem necessary to ensure the protection of the rest of the students. What is absolutely maddening about this, look, we can argue about whether background checks on the 18-year-old student would have prevented it. Apparently, he doesn't have a criminal record before other than entering the country illegally. But we do have this circumstance in which the Montgomery County superintendent just keeps going around and insisting, look, this horrible incident shouldn't change anyone's mind that those schools are safe for our students. And we work very hard, and our families and our community works very hard to keep all children safe in Montgomery County. Stop it. Stop saying that. The details of this rape are horrible. And let's emphasize, this happened during school hours. This happened on school property, and nobody stopped it. You can't brag about how safe your schools are. Now, look, I don't want every single kid who's here illegally through no fault of their own trying to get an education. I don't want them living under a perpetual cloud of suspicion. I don't want them picked on. I don't want them being targeted. But on the other hand, I want safe schools, too. And nothing is going to fuel the fires of suspicion of immigrants and suspicion of illegal immigrants than a guy running around insisting the schools are safe, just days after a violent rape occurs in his schools. Why is this guy more upset with the parents protesting outside than what happened on his watch? This guy's an education professional. Protecting the kids is his job. So it is a great tension there in Montgomery County. Montgomery County is part of a deep blue liberal Maryland. But, once it hits home like that, you will see a lot of parents rightfully asking, hey, wait a minute, what are you doing to protect our kids? And is it really such a good idea to be taking in the illegal immigrants students who, by the way, as you noted in the introduction to this, Greg, he's 18 years old. Because English is not his primary language and because he had no real school records, under the school policies, if you have no school records demonstrating you have credits or hours of education at another school, you're automatically enrolled as a freshman. So you have this 18-year-old kid in a bunch of class with a bunch of 14-year-olds. By itself, is this automatically going to be trouble? No, but we look at that today and it now suddenly looks like maybe that policy is worth further evaluation there. It's an ugly situation, and there's this nagging feeling that school administrators are now in the full CYA mode instead of really looking at what they can do to ensure safety for kids.
Well, good for the parents of Montgomery County. I'm sure they'll be reassured that the heavily Democratic state legislature has decided to respond to this by trying to make Maryland a sanctuary state. Definitely the rational response to this. Governor Larry Hogan, not exactly pleased with that. So we'll see where the votes come down on that.
We also probably should point out, Greg, that the city of Rockville and the county are like, look, we're not really a sanctuary city or sanctuary county. When somebody gets arrested, we do check with the FBI and Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Greg, did you ever see that really off-color Chris Rock routine?
Which one?
It doesn't really narrow it down. The one about people who want special credit for doing things they're supposed to do. When we arrest someone, we check if they have further criminal records with the FBI and with immigration. That's what you're supposed to do. What do you want, a cookie? Why is this considered extraordinary? That seems like the first thing you do when you'd arrest somebody. Hey, has this guy committed any other crimes? Let's check. As you can tell, this has my blood pumping.
It should. It should have everybody's blood pumping. Let's move on to the crazy martini now. And, Jim, I take you to the pages of the Washington Post, where they remind us that democracy dies in darkness. And I'm not sure whether they're the darkness or whether they're fighting the darkness. Or anyway, they needed a slogan, and that's their slogan. They are running an opinion piece by Susan Rice, the former U.N. ambassador, former Obama national security advisor, and she's writing about the fact that British intelligence and Jim Comey and intelligence key personnel in Capitol Hill and elsewhere have basically said they've seen no evidence that backs up what Donald Trump said about Obama ordering surveillance on Trump Tower. So Susan Rice writes this piece with the headline, Susan Rice, : when the White House twists the truth, we are all less safe. Oh, don't worry. The irony gets deeper. Here's the second paragraph. The foundation of the United States' unrivaled global leadership rests only in part on our military might, the strength of our economy, and the power of our ideals. It is also grounded in the perception that the United States is steady, rational, and fact-based. To lead effectively, the United States must maintain respect and trust. So when a White House deliberately dissembles and serially contorts the facts, its actions pose a serious risk to America's global leadership among friends and adversaries alike. Jim, in a vacuum, that's right. But why would you get the person who peddled the video causing the Benghazi terrorist attack as the arbiter of virtue when it comes to presenting the facts on a case?
You know, Greg, this is kind of like Chelsea Clinton denouncing nepotism. And there are a couple figures who are like this, who do things that, I don't think this is a crazy ideological, only right-wingers would think this. Or at least you shouldn't have to be a crazy right-winger to think this. But when Dan Rather lectures us about journalistic ethics and the importance of getting the story right, when you have a situation like this, when you have – apparently the Washington Post is doing a Q&A with Donna Brazile today, Greg. I wonder if she got the questions in advance, right? Like certain people do certain things and we go, wow, that's really bad. There should be a really serious consequence for that, right? Dan Rather would be one. Donna Brazile would be one. And you'd think Susan Rice would be in there because there's really no way to say, oh, everything she said about the Benghazi attack being caused by a video, all of that was false. And she went out and she did all the Sunday shows and she really stuck by it. She emphasized it. And even people ask, wait, you know, there were rocket-propelled grenades. Who brings rocket-propelled grenades to a political protest? But she stuck by it. She dug in her heels. And then we learned the truth. You'd think the Washington Post editors would say, you know, when we need somebody to really wrap the Trump White House on the knuckles for not telling the truth, do we have somebody besides Susan Rice to carry this message? Is there anybody else? No. All right, let her do it then. So, unless this is kind of like this, you know, joyful trolling of folks like this. But I mean, again, like, you know, here's the message there was about Trump saying that he had been wiretapped at Trump Tower. Clapper said it's not true. Comey said it's not true. The House Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes couldn't find any evidence it was true. The Senate Intelligence – nobody could find any evidence of this. It's a perfectly fair, legitimate criticism of Donald Trump. Donald Trump should retract the accusation. And they bring out Susan Rice to do this. Right? I mean, can you think – like, look what they've done, Greg. They've made us defend Trump, right? I can't back Susan Rice when she's making that argument because she's the epitome of what she's trying to denounce. So – That's where we are. We've come full circle, and it turns into this rallying cry pretty much every day since November, Greg. That's how you got Trump. Right. Well, you know, sending out Susan Rice to denounce dishonesty, that's how you got Trump.
What an amazing day. Jim, talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.